Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Bronte scholar Rosie Grant and Anne Bronte biographer Samantha Ellis celebrate the enduring feminist legacy of Anne Bronte, a pioneering voice in Victorian literature. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, our panel explore Anne's writings and how they continue to resonate with modern audiences and inspire generations of feminists.
And welcome to the second of our Anne Bronte events this afternoon in this very glamorous ballroom. This session is called Breaking Boundaries, Anne Bronte's Feminist Legacy, and I can't think of two writers more ably qualified to tackle this. Samantha Ellis, author and playwright and former trustee of the Bronte Society, is the author of Take Courage, Anne Bronte and the Art of Life, a surprising and personal journey into the life and work of Anne Bronte. And Rose Gant, a doctoral researcher in English literature at the University of Suffolk. Her research interests lie in Victorian literature, romantic poetry and the Gothic. She's working on a book about Victorian biography and she also volunteers at the Bronte Parsonage Museum. Okay, so let's start with each of your journeys into Anne. Would it be fair to say she wasn't your first love?
No, well, anyone that knows me knows that my PhD is on Branwell Bronte. But of course, whenever you start looking into the Brontes, they all kind of come towards you. So similarly to Nick in the last talk, my first academic route into the Brontes was looking at Wuthering Heights in my first year of university, which was really wonderful. So starting off with Emily, although I'd read Jane Eyre before and absolutely loved it. And I kind of came to Anne when I was doing my master's. We did a really interesting module on critical theory and the overall topic was monsters, mothers and movements. So I leaned into the monsters and I was kind of looking similarly to what I'm doing now, but a lot more in depth in my research into Victorian biography and kind of how Branwell, in a lot of ways, a lot of people like to think of him kind of as the monster. And then looking at the Tent of Wildfell Hall and kind of seeing the parallels between him and Arthur and how he may or may not have inspired elements of him. So that was kind of my first route into Anne. But like I say, once you start looking into the Brontes, they all kind of take a hold of you because they're such an amazing family and Anne's so readable and her novels are just wonderful and her poetry. I'm a big fan of Bronte poetry. That's followed me a lot into my academic journey so far.
I did not start with Anne. I was a Wuthering Heights obsessive. I was completely mad about Wuthering Heights. I read it every year for, I think, over 20 years. I used to read it every year on my birthday. And I wanted to marry Heathcliff. I was obsessed. And I got to my 30s and it was apparent this was not a good way to live one's life. And I decided to look back again at Wuthering Heights. And some of you know I wrote a book called How to Be a Heroine, which was looking back at Wuthering Heights and all the other fictional women who had either inspired me or led me astray or both. And I wrote that whole book. I did not consider Anne. There was loads about Jane Eyre. And then I was at the Bronte Parsonage, and obviously it's one of the most inspiring places in the world, as we all know. And I was there, and I was talking to Anne Dinsdale, who many of you know, and we started talking about Anne, and I thought, well, I've never really even thought about Anne. I'd read The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, but when I was about 13, so definitely too young for it. And literally on the bus back to Keighley and then on the train back to London, I started getting really excited about the idea of writing about Anne. And by the time I got to London, I decided I was going to try and write a biography, and luckily my publishers let me do it. But it's been a very long journey to get to Anne.
So, not your first love, but now a lingering love. So obviously Anne emerged onto a reading public. And how do you think how she was received in the first instance kind of affected her legacy going forwards, certainly in terms of those early biographies? Can I ask you to speak to that, please?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Again, as kind of Adele and Nick were kind of touching on in the last session, the kind of early reception to Anne and kind of the editing process of her work certainly didn't speak to an audience in the way that it would do today. a bit like my reading of Branwell, kind of Victorian attitudes towards kind of masculinity and like feminism in general, I suppose, certainly wouldn't have been as widely accepted as it was today. And because Anne's kind of so pioneering in her themes, in her writing, that certainly could appear off-putting to begin with, as we know with Charlotte's editing of her work and how she kind of tries to kind of put a safety blanket around Anne and say, oh, no, this, it shouldn't be as harsh as she kind of puts out originally. And of course, Charlotte controls the narrative greatly. The chapter I'm writing at the minute of my PhD is looking at the genre of Victorian biography and kind of how it's constructed. And of course, we know that Elizabeth Gaskell was only friends with Charlotte, and so therefore, and Patrick, of course, but that kind of suffers the way she portrays the rest of the family. And these ideas greatly have kind of stuck because public interest was so great for the Brontes at the time. They wanted to know about them and their lives. And when that's the earliest writing that's out there, inevitably some of the attitudes kind of stick.
I mean, I think it's a really curious, it's really curious because the first reviews of Anne's novel novels are saying that they are brutal and grotesque and violent and unwomanly. And then very, very quickly, she starts being seen as kind of sweet, pious, boring, partly because of Charlotte. But I mean, neither of those takes is really what you get when you then read an Anne Bronte novel, you know. And I think it's very odd that these two sort of opposing takes sort of were battling with each other, and yet the novels don't feel either of those things, I think.
When your book came out, Sam, The Independent described it as a deeply sympathetic and interesting reevaluation of a woman ahead of her time. Is that how you saw her? And was she the most out there of the Brontes, who actually were all pioneers in their own different ways?
Yeah, I mean, they were all pioneers. Yeah, I agree, they were all pioneers. But I think there were things that Anne did that were very interesting. I mean, I know we've just been talking about Agnes Grey, so not too much about that, but, you know, very interesting portrayal of a woman in her first job and facing all sorts of employment difficulties, you know, which I think a woman at work and misogyny in the workplace. I mean, you know, you could read that book, and you can read that book in a very modern way and really feel inspired by how Agnes deals with all those problems and issues. And Tennant Wellfall, I mean, you know, she writes about a woman leaving her husband. It's illegal. She takes the child away with her again. You know, she has to assume a new identity. She does it in the dead of night. No one else was writing about this. Hardly anyone else was writing about this. And no one was really writing about it positively. There are books like East Lynne where they say, never, never, never leave, you know. And there are many books about the tragedies of women who've left their husbands and terrible things occur. She has a new life and does her best by her husband and by her ex-husband in his hour of need, and then builds herself a new life and brings up her son as a feminist, I would say. I mean, I just think this is quite extraordinary for the time in which she was doing it and the circumstances in which she was doing it. You know, she wasn't being supported to do it. She didn't have a sort of network of people cheering her on. Her sisters were not wild about her writing about, you know, aspects of their brother or aspects of their life. They weren't wild about, Charlotte in particular wasn't wild about Anne writing things that would make Charlotte's own work seem dodgy or unwomanly or degrading or all the things it was called. So I think that there is something that she had a desire in her to tackle these issues, even though she wasn't being supported to do it.
Similar to it, and just echoing agreement with everything you've just said, kind of having these leading themes in your texts at that time and how kind of alien that would have been to the audience to kind of even question leaving your husband in that situation, and how even today it's so difficult for so many women who go through similar circumstances. So to kind of have Anne with that forward thinking at the time, it is really radical for the period, which is really refreshing to see, to kind of have one of the Brontes question those kind of attitudes towards women when feminism was so early.
Yeah. And I also think it's kind of quite radical now. You very rarely get stories now about people leaving you know, abusive marriages and having, I mean, there are some, but I remember when I was pitching radio plays in the 90s, and I was told you can have someone think about leaving their marriage, but they've got to decide in the end that they're going to go back. And this is to Radio 4. And I just remember going, really? Like, why do they have to decide that in the end? You know, and I just, you know, it's still radical now, I think. Mm-hmm. The happy ending she gives her heroines. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's probably not surprising that it's taken so long for her to have her moment and rise to where she needs to be critically and popularity-wise. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think it was as long as the Bronte Bicentenaries before Anne's legacy was really starting to get purchase in popular culture, or did it happen before that? I know it's been bubbling for a while, but you know, often people say it wasn't till actually relatively recently that people have started to really realise that this is quite extraordinary, groundbreaking work that speaks to modern women today.
Mm-hmm. It certainly seems that way. I mean, from my own experiences of kind of writing and researching about Anne, it didn't really come about until around the bicentenary time. And even now, slowly, we're talking more about her novels, but there's still a lacking there, which is really frustrating. When you think of the Brontes, it's still Charlotte and Emily. And attitudes, when you go to the parsonage, poor Anne and Branwell are kind of the underdogs. In a lot of ways, to a lot of people, that makes them more appealing. But they aren't underdogs at all. When you kind of reevaluate the family collectively, and luckily with the bicentenaries, that's kind of brought a new resurgence to all four of them. But it certainly feels like we're a long way behind where we probably should be for Anne now.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Sally Wainwright's To Walk Invisible was amazing in terms of actually telling the whole story, you know, almost the whole family story. But it did give Anne's story a bit more weight than it's had, I think, previously. There was a play, Underdog, recently, which I think, again, was very focused on, you know, on Anne and Charlotte. And in a very fun way, actually. You know, I think she's starting... It's always interesting to see in the kind of fictional, in the fictional treatments, she's starting to become more of a character. And I think that often leads the way, you know, for biographers and academic. But actually, feminists started reclaiming Anne in the 60s, I'd say. You know, the feminist scholarship that I was reading for my book was started really in the 60s and then come on. And then it's very interesting, from the 90s onwards, you get feminist comedians really reclaiming Anne. So, you know, that you get Bridget Christie, who wrote her show, A Bic for Her, about, you know, the advertising Bic pens for women, pink ones. She sort of writes about, and she's got Anne as a character in that, kind of stomping around, you know, wanting to use a big man's pen, you know. And, you know, Sarah Solomon playing her and being psychoanalyzed in the comedy show Psycho Bitches, and she has Charlotte and Emily teasing Anne, and just saying, my book sold out in 6 weeks. it's just quite funny. She shouldn't say anything else, she's just like that. You know, so it's interesting that they sort of almost paved the way, you know. I think there was a lot of that going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I interviewed Samira Ahmed quite recently.
Oh, she's been great about
it. And she said all the time she was battling the BBC over the gender pay gap, she was thinking of Anne Bronte and going, take courage, be strong.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I just thought, how cool is that?
So cool.
You know, it really is.
I mean, Anne would be delighted to know that she helped sort out the gender pay gap at the BBC, imagine.
So just returning to your book for a minute, Sam, your journey, literal and metaphorical, is woven into your quest to get to know and understand the real Anne, which gives it a real sense of freshness and urgency. Did you intend to be so in that narrative? It almost feels like you're talking to Anne at times, reanimating.
Oh, like that. I wasn't sure. I mean, I sort of when I pitched the book, I said, I'm not really a biographer. And I also felt I'm a bit impatient with cradle to grave objective biographies, because I'm not sure we can be objective. With the Brontes, what I found was I was reading other biographies, and the primary sources are not massive, are they? I mean, it's not a lot. There's not a lot. And so I thought, well, I've probably read most of what, you know, these other biographers have read. How are they so certain on this issue when I can see that it's very unclear? Or so I thought from the beginning, I'm going to say, it's unclear, but my guess is this because of that, or there are three theories. This is the most entertaining, though this is the one most plausible, in my opinion. You know, I already thought I was going to do that. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to kind of not pretend to be objective, maybe I should just try and meet her, encounter her. And also I had, apparently this is Hermione, Lisa's biographers always do this, so I'm feeling good company, but I started having these dreams about her at the start of the writing process, and she was sort of appearing at the edge of my bed going, why haven't you, why can't you hurry up and write the book about me? And I sort of thought, well, okay, I'm just going to abandon, you know, I'm just going to try and be as rigorous as I can, not abandon rigor, not abandon scholarship, but just try to meet her as a 21st century person, woman, feminist, and just to kind of encounter her, you know. And then I thought, if other people are meeting her in a different way, they can go, well, this bit doesn't resonate with me, so I'm going to ignore what Samantha says about this point, and this is how I feel. And, you know, they have more space to get in there. And actually, the letters I've had from readers suggested they've very much done that. They've wildly disagreed with large sections of it, fine. But they have found their own way through to her, which is what you want. I think.
The thing with all biographies, inevitably, and with all writing, the writer puts themselves in the book, which is spoken about a lot if you're kind of in the process of writing. And I think what your biography does excellently is there's no shame in your voice is there equally alongside Anne's. And it's very entertaining to read, whereas a lot of biographers kind of try and hide the fact that their own personal opinion kind of intercepts what they're trying to show about Anne in the first place. So I think that works really well in contemporary biographies in particular, to kind of present, okay, this is my experience of reading Anne, and this is what I've learned, and this is what's there. Whereas the more kind of Victorian biography is very much like, I'm going to present my opinion as a fact. And I think that's how lots of myths get misconstrued.
But I mean, I'd love to know what you, because Daphne du Maurier's book on Branwell is super opinionated.
Absolutely. Which I think is interesting when you compare it with Winifred Guerin's work on the Brontes and her biographies, because they're very opposing. Daphne doesn't kind of hide that her voice and her opinions greatly overtake the narrative. I was discussing this with Adele earlier and how misogynistic she can be towards Aunt Branwell. But Guerin very much, again, tries to kind of hide behind the facts, which works when comparing the two, because they've got they're very different tonally. So it's interesting to kind of see both kind of works at play at the same sort of time.
The Brontes have all been accused of using Branwell as a model for unsavoury men.
Absolutely.
And obviously with particular reference to Huntingdon. I wondered, since you are our official Branwell champion in the room, what you'd like to say about that?
Interesting. Okay. So when I talk about Branwell, I always like to say you cannot excuse all of his actions. I don't want to say that he was a saint and he was perfect, because of course, no one is. There's no way of presenting any sort of human being as unflawed. Paul Branwell, we can kind of understand a little bit better from our own contemporary perspective of what possibly he was going through from what he's left behind. Again, it's kind of piecing it together from our own understanding and my perspective. But for anyone, again, I think it's a lot of people, particularly with Sally Wainwright's To Walk Invisible, which was absolutely wonderful, but it's showing kind of one of the most difficult periods of Branwell's life towards the end. And lots of people like to kind of labour on the negative. So it's very easy to kind of use Branwell as the scapegoat sometimes for these horrible men that the Brontes kind of often portray in their novels. And while certainly you can't outright say there's not elements of Branwell in there, because we all write from experience, but it's kind of offering that sort of sympathetic light as well. And it's not, you can't tarnish someone entirely with that narrative. So I like to try and be a bit more balanced when you're looking at Branwell. At least that's what I try and give to other people.
So just sticking with Branwell for a moment, how important was Branwell to Anne's feminist legacy? Could you talk to us a little bit about your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So interesting, obviously the whole family were very close. You wouldn't, apart from their time in employment together, you can't draw too much of a line between Anne and Branwell, but certainly you've got Anne's drive for work, and kind of, it shows the closeness in that she wanted Branwell to come and join her in her employment, trying to help him kind of get back to what he wants to achieve as well, which is really lovely. So she's using her voice and authority and her kind of close relationship with the Robertson family to help Bramwell out, which I think is really lovely to show that sibling bond still remains there. And even when Bramwell remains there a bit longer, then Anne, she's had the longest employment out of all the Brontes. So she's very, so like hardworking, and the fact that to sustain a job for that long and enjoy it and have that kind of relationship and then to share that with Bramwell, even if he's kind of, unfortunately, again, kind of going down a different rabbit hole of infatuation with Mrs. Robinson at this point. It kind of shows Anne's autonomy and how she's driven to kind of make her own decisions aside from Bramwell. It's nice that they have that kind of journey together, but she's strong enough to have her own voice and say, I'm not going to let Bramwell dominate this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think their relationship is really interesting. As you say, she gets him a job and then it very quickly goes wrong. I mean, you know, I also think she probably, just the fact that he gets paid so much more than her, mm-hmm. and she has to live in the house with the kids she's teaching and he gets to live out somewhere and, you know, have mm-hmm. fun and have, you know, drunken nights out, whereas she's basically living with her, you know, with the kids she's teaching and sort of on call 24/7 and mm-hmm. having this horrible time. And then of course he has an affair with their employer and it all just implodes. And, you know, she's been there, as you say, for several years. She's trusted. It's not what you want for your brothers to turn up and ruin everything for you. And he's being paid more and he's having a better time. He doesn't even mm-hmm. need to do it. You know, he could have mm-hmm. had an affair in the village, you know, easily without bothering. You know, he was free to do that. He chose the one person to have an affair with that would make everything, would ruin everything. Mm-hmm. And I think it says a lot that after that, you do, even after that, you get instances of their bond, as you say. You know, Anne was the one who discovered him having set his bedclothes on fire mm-hmm. and he probably fell asleep while smoking, you know, while reading, and the candle went out, or possibly while smoking something and the candle, you know, the bedclothes went on fire. She had to call Emily, who was stronger, physically stronger, to help her to save his life. And then I always think the end of the Ten at Wildfell Hall, where Helen, having left her husband, having had a horrifically abusive marriage, finally managed to leave him, get her son away. Mm-hmm. She finds out that her alcoholic husband, ex-husband, is dying. And you know what? She could just go, right, whatever. But what she does, she goes back and she stays with him and she comforts him and she looks after him until he dies. She stands by the choice she originally made to marry him, the fact that he is the father of her child, and she looks after him. And I think we talk a lot about how Anne was inspired by the bad things Bramwell did, but she was also there, you know, with him, looking after him at the end. And I think she puts that into her novel. I mean, I think there's something really beautiful there, that you mm-hmm. do forgive people, or you look after them no matter what. Mm-hmm. You respect the bonds that you've had with them. There are values higher than everything else, of care, of love, of affection, of her standing by a choice you've made, of someone being tied to you by the child you've had together in the book, and by being brother and sister in real life. And I think, I don't know, those pages feel very much Anne and Bramwell to me.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked a lot about how Anne has been a role model for, and hopefully long may it continue into the future. Mm-hmm. But who were her role models? I mean, in terms of her outspokenness, was it her siblings? Was it her father? Was it her aunt? Was it a combination? There's something about embracing the masculinity and the rules of the time and reclaiming them mm-hmm. that I find really compelling. Yeah. I wondered what you thought about her role models.
I mean, I think she has lots of role models, as you say, her aunt, mm-hmm. Aunt Bramwell, as she's always called. But I mean, I just chose in the biography to call her Elizabeth because that's her name, you mm-hmm. know, and I just found her a bit. I mean, she's a really interesting woman, you know, she dropped everything to look after her sister's six motherless children mm-hmm. She's having a lovely time living in Cornwall. She does not want to go to Yorkshire and like look after these small children who are grieving their mother, and she does it. I mean, what an amazing woman. I mean, really, she doesn't get her due. And, you know, and when you look at the criticisms of her, it's that she's a bit religious. that she wore shoes that clacked. And you just go, really? Are we criticising this woman who looked after six, she brought up six children because she wore noisy shoes? You know, I found that. But I think she's a really interesting character. Mm. I think Maria Branwell, the mother of the Brontes, although Anne obviously doesn't, you know, didn't get to spend any time with her, really. It's tragic. But her memory would have been in the house the whole time. People would have been talking about her the whole time. And I think Sharon Wright's book really sort of explores her sort of, you know, she was a much stronger person, I think, she's been painted. I think the Wooler sisters, who ran Roehead School, where Anne, Charlotte and Emily briefly studied, were really interesting, quite striking, quite a proper sisterhood of, you know, of teachers. And I think they pop up quite a lot. I think the teacher in Jane Eyre who comforts Jane and gives her seed cake after she's sort of been unfairly punished, I think she's Miss Wooler again, you know. I think they pop up quite a lot. And then I think there are also characters in that they would only have read about. I was very interested about Caroline Norton, who was a society author and beauty. She married a man who turned out to be violent, horribly abusive. She left him. He dragged her through the courts claiming that she was having an affair with the prime minister. He got custody of all their children. She managed to get a law passed to allow her to get access to her children, but it only applied in England. He took the children across the borders of Scotland. One of them died. I mean, it's the most horrific story. This was in the front pages of the papers that the Brontes were reading, and we know that they were all voracious readers of the news, of politics. They were really interested in the outside world. All of this stuff crops up all the time in all of their work. And I think, you know, Caroline Norton became sort of unwilling, sort of, you know, reluctant crusader and activist. And I think Anne was definitely drawing on her story for the Tenant of Wildfell Hall, definitely.
Absolutely. Also, I think it's really interesting to think about all the figures that you named as inspirations for Anne, particularly looking at kind of the relationship she had very temporarily in real life with Maria, her mother, and kind of how that memory and how we can all still be inspired by people who we've lost who are close to us. I think that's what makes Anne so not just readable, but so intriguing to an audience today, because we can kind of greatly sympathize with what she's been through with loss and kind of how that spurs her on. I'm doing this a lot in my reading of Branwell, of course, but where he often gets kind of bulked down by the loss and kind of uses it to like spur her on to a degree. And I think that's really important to think about. And I think that's a way that contemporary audiences can still relate to her today. Certainly, in my opinion, I feel greatly inspired by people I've been close to and then lost. So I really recognise that in Anne, and I think it's really important to her.
Where does faith figure in all of this? Because obviously that bulks large in most conversations about Anne. Was there something about her spiritualism, that her relationship with the Bible, with God, with religion, that also sustained her, but it's disproportionately attributed as being, you know, one of her reasons for being?
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting, when I first came to Anne, that's kind of the perspective you get of her. She's so devoutly religious, and that's kind of all she's known for. And while that can be a great anchor of hope, and certainly with Patrick and his teachings surrounding the Brontes throughout their lives and from such a young age, it's certainly there. But kind of having that as her soul like purpose and attribution, it does kind of try and lessen her own autonomy, I think.
Yes, but I also think Patrick is a great advocate of making up your own mind. You know, he is not a kind of, he's not Joseph in Wuthering Heights, you know, he's not sort of laying down the law. I mean, he let his children read everything. I mean, it's amazing the shocking stuff they were reading Byron, they were reading everything as little kids. And there's a famous story about a woman who came to him for advice actually on leaving her abusive husband. And he said, yes, you should leave. And she didn't take his advice. I mean, it's extraordinary that he gave the advice to leave. And she came back years later to say, I have finally got free of him, but I wish I'd taken your advice, because, you know, the abuse went on. He gave me syphilis and he left. And it's the most extraordinary. And, you know, Patrick's children were hearing all of this. And they heard that their dad, you know, had advised had advised this woman, in this case, the moral thing to do is to leave, whether the church says and whether the, whatever the law says. So I think, and I think Anne's faith is very like that as well. She doesn't take anything as read. It's very much about making up your own mind and living your values. And I think I'm always really wary about, I was brought up Jewish, so I'm always very wary about saying anything about any faith that isn't my own. But I do think, like, you know, we can all get behind the idea of having core values that we live by and developing our values ourselves with, you know, advice and learning from other people, but deciding what we what we want to live by and then sticking to that. And I think Anne is very good on that, whatever faith you're reading her from. And I, yeah, as you say, this sort of idea that, you know, that she's sort of almost oppressed by a kind of piousness, it is not what I encounter when I read her.
I'm really taken with the idea of her being, her using the grief as a positive fuel to keep her going. Because again, one of the other myths is she was just waiting to die. She could hardly breathe. She was tiny. She was frail. She was just waiting for her calling, which was, you know, which was utterly ludicrous.
Absolutely.
The idea of her being positively charged by grief. I mean, obviously she didn't want any of that to have happened, but that is... That shows extraordinary resilience to turn so much pain into power and empowerment, and quite unusual. I mean, we always think of the Victorians particularly, they were always in black, they were always mourning, and it was seen as quite a negative thing. But actually, what you're saying is that actually it can be a very potent regenerative force.
Absolutely.
And do you think she consciously channeled that?
Well, interesting. I would say it's interesting when you look at like the very stereotypical Victorian representation of mourning. Despite all the grief and loss that the Brontes endured, none of them succumbed to that. Even though Paul Bramwell gets very melancholic in his writings to a degree, that's not how they choose to live their lives. They choose to kind of move forward. And so I think it's interesting because they are not just continuously surrounded by loss in terms of people that they lose around them. If you look at their physical surroundings, being surrounded by the graveyard and that terms of loss, you kind of consciously know that it's there. But I wonder if it's more, I feel for Anne, it's probably more of an unconscious hope in the back of her mind, kind of keeping her driving forward, as opposed to Bramwell, who actively engages with it in his writing. I think you've kind of got the contrast there. But it always remains a part of you. And so I think kind of having that in your mind.
Yeah, I mean, she writes about grief really interestingly, I think. And again, the grief that Helen feels for her husband after he dies, even after what he's put her through, he's still someone that she loved once. And she cares for him to the end. And she does grieve him. And then when she's ready, she moves on. She's, you know, there's nothing kind of, she gives it the time that it needs, you know, she gives grief the space that it needs. And I'm like, I find that really powerful. And I'm completely, this whole Anne was waiting to die just absolutely does my head in. I mean, she went to Scarborough because that was the cure. That was the way that you might get better or at least stay alive longer. She went to Scarborough to try to live, you know, she didn't go to die. And I often see people writing as though she went there because she wanted to die by the sea. No, she wanted to try and live, and she wasn't wrong. You know, she wasn't wrong. I mean, it did prolong people's lives. It did, you know, it could help people. She always writes about wanting to live, you know, and wanting to live her life to the fullest and to do what she could. And I think it's amazing she managed to get to Scarborough and see the sea again, which she loved so much. You know, I think that must have been a comfort when she was dying.
On the Bronte Gothicometer, where would you put Anne?
I don't want to say smack bang in the middle, but like if you, depends who we're putting on the scale. I feel like obviously Emily Bramwell's pretty high up, I feel. Anne's close. Charlotte, it's interesting.
Charlotte goes quite gothic.
Well, yeah.
Jane Eyre.
Yeah. It's interesting that my first thought was Charlotte not on the gothic scale as much, actually, when Jane Eyre's so obviously there.
Yeah. But she does go more, I mean, Charlotte goes more realist as she goes on, doesn't she?
Absolutely.
Starts out quite realist. So to tell her, rather, I mean, she's got this She's got an artist, a mysterious artist, mm-hmm. living in a ruined house, and the topiary is all kind of going wild and looking like fantastical beasts in the kind mm-hmm. of half light and the storms and the, you know, I mean, she's got plenty going mm-hmm. on, hasn't she?
Absolutely.
It's interesting. She is always, she's always described as the realist, isn't she? But mm-hmm. I think, as you say, Charlotte does get quite more realist as she goes.
Yes, exactly. I think that's where my mind went to begin with, thinking of Shirley and how so many people like to attribute that to Anne and kind of this like piousness. Yeah, that's where my mind goes to. Yeah.
In fact, it's all about work and about class and about... It's interesting that. I like the idea of a Gothic opera. I feel like we need to have one here. Next year, we'll get
definitely,
one.
Definitely. Before we go to questions, I wondered if you might read us just a little bit from your wonderful book.
Thank you.
Sam. That'll give everyone time to sharpen their pencils and get their questions ready.
Okay, I'm going to read a really tiny bit from the end. This is sort of where I got to with Anne, having not really seen the point of her before I wrote the book. But that's the point. That's why you write books. In The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, Huntingdon returns from a debauched trip to London and he taunts Helen. I've lived more in these 4 months, Helen, than you have lived in the whole course of your existence. But as Anne charts the monotony of all his drunken nights, it's clear he's not really living. He's not savouring life. Anne's life was sheltered and short, but she took courage and she lived it to the full. She showed that you don't have to be privileged to be a writer. You don't have to be happy. You can be a woman. You can grow up in a single parent family. You can be shunned as an immigrant, so your brother is burned in effigy in the street. You can be so poor that two of your sisters die of neglect at a failing school that doesn't feed them enough or notice they're ill until it's too late to save them. So poor that you ration butter, paper and postage. You can have just 2 years of formal education. You can have a recluse for a sister and a drug addict for a brother. You can have debilitating asthma. You can be depressed. You can struggle with your faith. You can be cold almost every day of your life. You can be ignored at work and bullied by your employers. You can be laughed at by other women for your patched and worn and unfashionable clothes. You can be paralysed by such shyness that you barely ever make a friend. You can see terrible cruelty and be unable to stop it. You can be powerless and know that the laws of your country will not help you. And you can still write things that make people cry and laugh and think and feel years after you died young, 100 miles from home, which apart from one weekend in London is the furthest you have ever travelled in your life. And maybe you can be forgotten and then remembered again, maybe. Every year, someone sends flowers to the parsonage on Anne's birthday. They never say who they are. This year, I'm sending flowers too.
Oh. Okay, over to you. Who'd like to go with the first question? Gentleman towards the back.
I didn't realise you had a mic. But what I was thinking was this, that... Before Anne Van Well and Emily died, they were all the books were published as ostensibly by male authors. Was anybody taken in by that? I mean, The Tenants of Wildfell Hall and Wuthering Heights have got this have got a narrator in them, which is very obviously a man. But Agnes Grey feels so autobiographical, with a little bit of wishful thinking at the end. And I could imagine her having a crush on this really wonderful curate. And then Cold Comfort Farm. There was a character in Cold Comfort Farm written in the 30s who was trying to prove that Bramwell wrote all the books. What do you think?
I don't think even Rose is going to...
That bit in Cold Comfort Farm makes me laugh a lot. I find it very entertaining.
Yeah.
But the way that so many people still kind of like, oh yeah, maybe Bramwell could have written them. No, let the girls have their own voices. Yeah.
I'd question whether they were male pseudonyms. I think they were androgynous. And there was fierce speculation at the time. And there's a brilliant review, I can't remember who it was by, but it was, interestingly, it was by a woman writing under a male pseudonym who went on and on about how it definitely must have been a woman. There were, I can't remember whether it was that review or somewhere else, but they talked about a bit about sewing on curtain rings, which couldn't have been written by a man. That's right. Couldn't have been written by a man. And, you know, I mean, people were literally going, this curtain ring bit, there's no way. and you know, people were saying, well, they must have had, if it was a man, maybe he had a female confidant. You know? I mean, it's not that much of a stretch to think that, you know, if a man had wanted to write about curtains, he could have asked someone or maybe tried and seen how to do it, you know, himself. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there was fierce speculation. I don't think anyone said it's definitely men. I don't think there was any of that. As far as I can remember, I think people were sort of assuming that these slightly odd names were not real names, and why did they all have the same surname, and was it one person? And so I think there was always that at the time. But I think their refusal to say who they were originally was a real driver of the anger in the reviews, I think, because people sort of wanted to know who has written this book, you know, so I can have a go at them in my review. You know, they wanted a target, I think, didn't they?
Absolutely.
Lady there.
Thank you. I've just finished reading Agnes Grey, and as an older woman, the impression I've got, yes, is Anne Bronte writing a lot about herself and her experience and her quietness and being trapped within the society in which she lived and managed. But her mother is fantastic. And there's not enough really said about this character. I wondered what you'd like to say about this woman who, you know, becomes a widow and is saying, no, I'll set up a school, I'll go this, we'll build that, we'll, you know, what a woman.
She's fantastic. The mum is fantastic. And, you know, she supports her daughter going to get a job, you know, and she sort of goes off and does it. I mean,
gentle, yeah, she's feminist, modern.
She's really wonderful. And her sort of can-do attitude and, you know, the way she's raised her two daughters to be these women. Yeah, I love the mother in Agnes Grey. And
is that the real Anne Bronte? I mean, she didn't have her mother. Or is she writing about her sisters, that character, that strength, that determination?
I mean, maybe she's writing about the mother she would like to have known. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to say, but the mother
was spoken of.
Yes.
In the family.
Maybe. I mean, you know, there's something. But I think the sort of can-do, practical side of that character is possibly maybe her aunt a little bit, or Tabby, who was their housekeeper for a long time, was this very kind of motherly, kind of can-do sort of character in their lives, you know, and I think she's not given the credit she, you know, could have been. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that, you know, there's so many absent and dead mothers in Victorian fiction in general, and, you know, Agnes Grey has a mother who's there, present, vivid, living, inspiring, is on the page, you know. Anne's made that choice, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in The Tenant Wildfell Hall, her heroine is a mother. So she's actually she's a very good writer on motherhood, I'd say. And she really thought about it. She must, and of course, because she was a governess, she's watching people mother their children, often badly, it has to be said. And she's got her views on that, you know. So though she never became a mother herself, I think she was really, really interested in motherhood. She never really had a mother, and she never became a mother. Yet she writes brilliantly about motherhood, I think.
Mm-hmm. Maybe at the back, and then we'll come to these two questions.
I would argue that The Tenant of Wildfell Hall is the best Bronte novel. And I wondered what your thoughts on that are, and perhaps why you think it's been so overshadowed by the other Bronte novels. For me, I think on a personal level, I am a woman that left a man who was unkind to me. So it speaks to me in that sense. Is it that in those times it was so scandalous to do that? Is it that it was just seen as too shocking? Because to me, it's such a readable book and the characters are so vivid. And I just think that it's just the best one. And I don't understand why there's so much made of the other novels, if that makes sense.
It's certainly one of my favourites as well, so I completely agree with everything you've said. I suppose with Wuthering Heights, lots of people like to be more kind of shocked by the nature of that. I suppose similar to Tennant to a degree in having a woman leave is so radical for the time. It's interesting that it was so overshadowed when today it's so poignant still, and it speaks to so many people, and it's so accessible to read.
I think a big problem was its publication history as well. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it came out under the pseudonym, by the way, the pseudonyms, of course, were Emily's idea. She wanted to be private. So it came out under the pseudonym. No one knew who it was by. Lots of people were shocked by it. And then very soon afterwards, Anne died. She wasn't able to sort of manage her reputation. At that point, the public knew who the Brontes were. And immediately Charlotte refused to allow it to be reprinted. It was a bestseller at Anne's death. And Charlotte was the executor because she's next of kin, and she refused to allow it to be reprinted. So suddenly you couldn't get it in the shops, this best-selling novel.
So it wasn't actually overshadowed at the time, really. Sorry for interrupting. So was it quite popular at the time? So I don't know that much about
sold out.
It.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
It did sell out, as they said on Psycho Bitches, in 6 weeks. I mean, that was accurate. It did sell out. And then she wrote this, her sort of preface, which is an amazing piece of writing, wonderful piece of writing. She wrote the second edition. So that was also selling out. And then there was nothing available for years. And then what happened was a sort of fly-by-night operation decided to bring out an edition anyway, and they wanted it to fit in one volume. So they just cut bits, and they cut some of the best bits, and it's awful. Mm-hmm. You read the two side-by-side, and it's humiliating that this thing came out. And then after Charlotte died, Charlotte's publishers were then able to reprint it. And they just used that edition. They didn't know that was the wrong one. They didn't think to you know, that it wasn't available in its own edition. And then, of course, you know, everything, almost every time Anne's work was published after her death, it had Charlotte's biographical notice of Anne and Emily on the front of it, saying that the book was a mistake, that she felt that Anne was, you know, this quiet, pious, covered by a nun-like veil kind of character, you know, and that, I think, affected the way people then read it. So, I mean, you know, not Charlotte made decisions in the depths of her grief, which it would be awful to judge anyone for. However, those decisions have had a huge impact, I think. And I wonder if that hadn't happened, whether we'd be talking about it being overshadowed now. I don't know.
And how many editions today are still available in the edited format? Mm.
So many. I mean,
it's unbelievable. How many copies of Tenant have I got? I want to say about 10. It's not even much of an exaggeration, but I think that two or three of them are the full edition when you go back and look through, and it really does make such an impact on the novel.
Yeah.
Can we move the microphone down to the fabulous jumper in row 3? Please.
Hi. So I just wondered, obviously Helen is a very strong icon in Tenant of Arpa Hall. But I was wondering what your thoughts were on Rose Markham, because I love her and I think she's very underrated.
On who, sorry?
Rose Markham.
Oh, okay.
I mean, first of all, she's got a great name. So I have to say that. It's very exciting when you see your name in a Bronte novel. But she's wonderful too.
She is. I think there's something really... I mean, I think that her brother's education in that book, from being a bit of a, you know, boisterous kind of, you know, he ignores his sister, he just kind of comes home to eat, he sort of, you know, he bosses his mum and sister about, and he becomes sort of a feminist by the end of the book, and he is in the letter trying to, I think, educate someone else. You know, I think that Rose is as big a part of that as Helen, but I think Helen triggers his different relationship with Rose. But it would be interesting, I mean, if there was another film made of it, it would be interesting to see Rose given a bigger role, I think, because she's never quite had her space in the adaptations that I've seen.
There was a question over here on the front row. Oh, beg your pardon, there's one at the back first. You are definitely next.
Hey, just a general question about biographies. Do you think women write about women better than men write about women?
I mean, yes and no. To some degree, of course, because you've got the woman understanding their own experience. But in a lot of ways, in a lot of early biographies, again, women are kind of very negative towards women. And then kind of that impact lasts. If you look at the way that Gaskell talks about Charlotte versus the rest of the family and kind of how these attitudes have stuck and how it's a very contemporary approach to say women support women, but then even today we're very self-critical of each other. So that kind of lingers a lot in biography. And it's a shame that you've not got more women kind of championing women's voices. I think that's still very much an issue today, even though it's kind of slowly getting better.
I think also that it's not the only point of contact between the biographer and the subject. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I was anxious. I was anxious as an Iraqi Jewish woman writing a biography of an Irish British woman. I just thought maybe I'm going to get this, you know, completely wrong. You know, mm-hmm. I was terrified of writing about the Christianity. And maybe I did get it completely wrong. But one thing I found very interesting was I was very drawn to the Brontes as Irish, and they most of them had strong accents until they were adults. At least Patrick never lost his accent, as I said in that bit I just read. You know, Bramwell at one point was burned in effigy in the street. They made an effigy of him with a potato in one hand and a herring in the other, and they burned him in one of the shops on Main Street in effigy, you know, in the window. I mean, they did suffer a lot of anti-Irish racism, and that was something I was really interested in. And I was aware that I was interested in that because I'm from a family that's not from here, you know, and I was sort of, and so I think being a woman was only one part. For me, it was only one part of my connection to Anne. I think there was also that. And then someone might come along and find other points of contact. So, yeah, I can only speak about my own experience, but that for me was quite important.
Thank you. Very patient lady on the front row. Microphone's coming down to you now.
Yeah, as I'm sure you know, the Bronte biographer Edward Chittam has actually compared The Tenant of Wildfell Hall and Wuthering Heights, and has suggested that The Tenant is actually some sort of response to Wuthering Heights. When you think about all the names beginning with H, and we have a tenant and we have a slightly strange building in the middle. And when I came across this, I thought, well, why haven't I seen this before? You know, because there are so many sort of coincidences. And I'm still mulling this over in my own mind. I'm just wondering, you know, how you see it.
Okay, I'll start. I mean, I think The Tenant of Wildfell Hall is in large part a response to both Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights, and it uses a lot. I think the first thing that Anne was interested in is her sister. They'd all been through this experience. They were all going through this experience with their brother, who was causing absolute havoc. I mean, you know, really tormenting their father and them, having had a terrible love affair that he could not let go of, that was destroying him, he was destroying his family through alcohol and drugs and, you know, bad company, or everything. And they all went through this together. And I think Anne was a bit amazed that sisters wrote these characters who were a bit like that, and it was all supposed to be a happy ending. I mean, I think she was really, what? And so that's why she takes her character, she marries the charming, self-destructive, you know, man, and then it goes horribly wrong. She takes her beyond the altar. So I think she was sort of, there was definitely a sort of a conversation between having with both, and I think that's partly why Charlotte was not thrilled about Tenant Wildfell Hall, because she saw it as a critique of her book, which I think it was. And I also think, you know, they were all writing together, you know, they were walking round and round that table in the evening, talking about their ideas. We know that Anne and Emily used to go out on the moors and almost act out their improvise like actors their ideas and talk about them. So they were, you know, they were working together and they were working against each other and they were critiquing all the time. So Anne would have known how she felt about it, and, you know, that might have even been grist to her mill. So yes, I think absolutely that doesn't take away from the originality of her book, because I think actually, not that you were suggesting that, but I think actually it's a fascinating thing to critique a book by someone you're so close to that you've been part of the writing of. And it's sort of almost like spinning the story. Let's look at it another way. I mean, it's almost, I don't know, you could almost argue they were all sort of one novel, you know, they were sort of all coming at these ideas from different places, you know, the same biographical material largely. They were sort of exploring different ways. I think it's quite exciting that they were doing that. I find it quite exhilarating. Mm-hmm. And Bramwell possibly also, and we don't have enough of his.
Absolutely, and I think that makes it more interesting when you read each of the novels, kind of connecting the similarities between each of them. But they each have their own voices come through so strongly. And I think that's what makes them wonderful, because as Bronte fans, we can look at them and say, oh, look at that, look at the similarities there and look at what they were going through and how it kind of reflects that, but they all have their own voices in it, mm-hmm. which is really wonderful.
Yeah, thank you, that makes sense.
We're going to have to wrap now, but there's anyone I missed? Because is there anyone I missed? There's a very... Okay, we'll have one more question.
One more. I love these questions.
So we spoke about Tennant being a bestseller and selling out in 6 weeks, but it had such a bad reception. So do you think people were buying it because it was shocking, or more people kind of resonated with it than we kind of realise?
Certainly, really. I mean, the same way that this happens so often today as well. If everyone's talking about something, of course, you're kind of going to flock to it. So that certainly, I think, makes up a large part of it. I don't know if you...
I think so, definitely. Yeah. But I also think people were responding to it. I think
Absolutely.
People were seeing something in there that mm-hmm. was really, and continue to, you know, see something in there that really resonates with them. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, because women were not allowed to leave, were not able to leave, there were a lot more of these marriages about, you know, mm-hmm. there were a lot more women suffering in this way. Mm-hmm. And because of the way men were brought up and the state of Victorian toxic masculinity, which Branwell was arguably a victim of as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of men who were suffering in the way that Huntington was and his friends were, who were not able to get out of these cycles of drink and abuse and neglect of their wives and never managing to have a connection with someone proper and really having a happy life. So I think it probably had, I mean, there were a lot of people who I think were resonating with it, men and women. But yeah, I'm sure some people picked it up just because it, you know, had sex in it. And it, I mean, fair enough.
Well, thank you very much, Samantha Ellis and Rose Gant, for the most amazing session. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.